back in Ohio, where I come from. I've done a lot of dreaming and I've traveled some, but I never thought I'd see the day when I ever took a ride on the Santa Fe.
Wanna take a ride on the Santa Fe?
I would leave. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Of course, that's the great Judy Garland singing on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. It's from the movie The Harvey Girls. It seemed like an appropriate excerpt given the topic today, which is passenger rail in Ohio will expand, at least if the Obama administration has its way. The Obama administration last week doled out the dollars for developing a nationwide network of high-speed inner-city passenger rail services. Ohio's take of the $8 billion plan is $400 million for an inner-city line to connect Cleveland, Columbus, Dayton, and Cincinnati. There are already trains going out of Ohio from Cincinnati and out of Ohio from Cleveland, but none getting in here to the center. As you probably have heard, lots of people have been very vocal about their opposition to President Obama's plan. So far as I can tell, there's no organized opposition in Ohio, at least not yet. But there are some lawmakers who oppose the plan. Joining us later in the hour to explain his opposition will be State Senator John Houston. His Senate district in Hamilton County includes most of the suburbs around Dayton. So he has a vested interest one way or the other in this. Joining us later as well will be Patricia Quinn. She's executive director of the Northern New England Passenger Rail Authority, which she's been with them since September 2005, but with the passenger rail in New England since 2001. So that operation, the Northern New England Passenger Rail Authority, was mired in conflict when it opened in 2001, opened its line in 2001. It's now one of the fastest growing lines in the Amtrak system. And I'm curious about what did they do right and what kind of advice would they give Ohio as it develops its passenger rail. But first, to share the hopes and dreams and plans of the Ohio Rail Development Commission is Stu Nicholson. He's the spokesman for the commission. Welcome, Stu.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
I want to start out with a negative, not necessarily a negative comment, but what if Ohio didn't get the money? Where would Ohio be in the matrix if we weren't going to build this railroad?
I think at this point, if that happened, we would certainly be taking a look at what other federal sources are there out there, and certainly the prospect exists. Congress is still talking about a 6-year transportation bill that would set up a first ever passenger rail funding mechanism on a grant basis, much like we do for highways and aviation. This would be 20% state money to match to 80% federal. But again, that's still something that's kind of working its way through Congress, and we're watching it very intently, as are our fellow states in the United States, all over the United States. Because I think, as you recall, we were competing with 28 states for the money that we did get.
Exactly, and I was wondering, if Ohio didn't get the money, in other words, if Ohio couldn't build the railroad, where would we fit? I mean, would they just build one around Ohio?
I think
it's inconceivable in a way that they wouldn't have given Ohio the money. But on the other hand, what's good about having a railroad in Ohio?
Well, I think Governor Strickland acknowledged this last Thursday when he spoke, because he spoke about Ohio kind of being the donut hole, as I recall the quote correctly. We've been kind of a flyover state, you know, in the Amtrak system, quite literally since Amtrak began in the early 1970s. What we're doing here is trying to fill in the hole in the donut as a start, and fill it in more as we go along with more trains, better trains, more frequency, and frankly, more corridors as well. My counterpart at ODOT coined the phrase "changing the map," and that's exactly what we're doing. We are changing the map for transportation in Ohio with this.
I was looking at some letters to the editor in the Dispatch, and one letter writer compared this stage of passenger rail development in Ohio to like a foot in the door. It said, just as when the first roads he adores – I guess he was responding to another letter writer who didn't want railroads or passenger rail – just as when the first roads he adores were gravel and evolved into the interstates. Mm-hmm. So this is just a first step?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what President Obama did and certainly what Governor Strickland embraced, early on, I must say, but what the president did in putting that those dollars initially on the table was very much like what happened in the early 1950s when President Eisenhower announced that we were going to start pursuing an interstate highway system. If you look at the context of the times, very similar economy. We were in a recession. There was high unemployment. We were coming out of a war in Korea. And he had, as a general commanding the troops in Europe in World War II, had seen the German autobahns, these incredible, magnificent stretches of concrete, and said, why aren't we doing that here in the United States? So that's what got it going. But it got going in very much the same atmosphere as we're going through now.
You mean conflict, disagreement?
Well, yeah, certainly conflict, disagreement, an economy that's not, you know, where everybody thinks it should be and hopes it will get to. But imagine, if you will, if states had opted out, you know, and at that point, states had to pony up like 10%. To start as their share of building an interstate. But imagine, say, for instance, if Florida said, nah, we're not going to do that. We don't see the sense of it. Take a look at Florida today and consider what probably would not be there. Disney World, Cape Kennedy. Orlando would not be the city that it is today.
You know, but those are roads. Does passenger rail develop in the same way? Does it bring development in the same way that roads have?
Absolutely. And I think when you have Patricia Quinn on later, she will more than bear that out because that's certainly been the experience up in Maine. They just opened up a $2.5 million green station facility in Saco, Maine, and it's literally steps from a development worth over $100 million, a mixed-use development that is redeveloping an old textile mill into a mixed-use scenario. So, that development is there. She was beginning to see that kind of trickle in several years ago when she first came on board with the Passenger Rail Authority. And I think she will probably talk about what it's like today. But very definitely, rail does attract because the station becomes that kind of a magnet. It is a mobility producer. You know, you've got incoming passengers, you've got outgoing passengers, and they're all looking for, you know, if they're coming into the community, they're looking for places to go, they're looking for places to eat, they're looking for places to get a cup of coffee. They may be looking for, you know, for places to do business. And it very much is a magnet, and we're estimating that we will see that kind of development in Ohio.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stu Nicholson. He's the Public Information Officer for the Ohio Rail Development Commission. Joining us later, State Senator John Husted, he is opposed to the funding that has been put forth for passenger rail in Ohio. He's going to join us and tell us why. And then later, Patricia Quinn from Maine. She is the executive director of the Northern New England Passenger Rail Authority. And when it opened in 2001, even the owners of the railroads didn't want it. And now they can't wait to, build more tracks, apparently. You know, the obvious issue, the one that everybody always cares about, particularly given the economy, is the cost. And the federal package covers about 75% of the anticipated cost of startup. It doesn't cover the cost to operate, and it doesn't cover the cost of finishing the building of it. Where do you anticipate the rest of that money is going to come
from?
Well,
you know, we went in asking for $564 million. We got $400 million. But you have to also look at the fact that when we made our ask, we built in contingencies, a 30% contingency into that estimate, which is not uncommon with any major transportation project. What we're doing now, basically, is going back and getting together not only with our partners at ODOT, but also we have conversations that have to take place with the Federal Railroad Administration about what their expectations are. and see how we can get this done with the $400 million, and that's strictly for capital. That doesn't touch operating costs. Mm-hmm. Operating costs essentially, our report indicates, we've got a roughly $29 million total in operating costs annually. We're estimating $12 million of that will come out of passenger fares. And what we're working on, what we will be working on very intently over the next months, will be what kind of revenue sources can we also engage to bring in to cover those costs? Because certainly, I've heard Senator Husted talk about his concerns over the operating costs and how those are being covered. We share that concern. And we certainly want to work with the senator and others in the General Assembly to make sure that we're doing this in a cost-effective manner, and we're also being creative and in bringing in other revenue sources.
An emailer yesterday sent in a couple questions and some ideas when she found out this was going to be the show today, and she says she had some ideas about how to raise revenue and wonders what you think about them. Selling sponsorships, advertising on the trains and in the stations, issuing rail bonds, which Ohioans could purchase using their pension and IRA plans. The rail authority could – you hadn't thought of
that? That's actually pretty interesting, the idea of rail bonds.
Go Jody. The rail authority could sell deep discount prepaid rail passes. The earlier people buy them, the deeper the discount, that kind of a thing. So the bonds – there's an idea for you, but yeah. What about the deep discount rail passes?
I will take that back to my bosses. That is a very good idea. We're looking at all of that: advertising revenue, naming rights. I had somebody on a similar show yesterday say, "Well, what are you going to name the train?"
I wanted to ask that question.
Yeah, and it's a great question because if you're asking that and they're asking that, then. Hey, maybe there's some corporate entity out there that wants to put their tag on a train. President Gee, if you're listening at Ohio State University, we'd love to have you name at least one of them the Buckeye Bullet or something similar. We'll even put it in scarlet and gray colors. But that, in all seriousness, that is a potential source of revenue. Franchise fees. We're looking at franchising
at the station
at the station and on board services. You've got coffee, beverage service, meal service potentially on board. Who does that? Who provides that? And what is that worth to them to be that provider? A lot of interest in Wi-Fi service along the corridor. Amtrak just recently introduced Wi-Fi along the entirety of the Northeast Corridor between Boston, New York, and Washington. That is absolutely something that we must look at as a service, but also potentially as a revenue generator. I think there's that market out there for this, and the more we can go towards those things, the more revenue we can generate from sources other than the taxpayer's pocket. The other thing that our partners at ODOT have brought up is the Blue Sign Program on the highways, uh-huh. where essentially you take those revenues from the Blue Sign Program. Where companies advertise to say, well, our gas station is at this next exit, or our restaurant or our hotel is at that next exit. Well, they have to pay to be on those signs. So that's potentially a revenue source. So we're trying not to take anything off the table at this point. And as I said, we want to work with the members of the General Assembly because, frankly, if Jody, the emailer, comes up with an idea like that about using rail bonds, then they might have some ideas as well, and we want to work with that.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to have to take a quick break. We're talking about passenger rail in Ohio. We've got $400 million now from the federal government. What are we going to do with it? Stu Nicholson, he's a public information officer for the Ohio Rail Development Commission. He'll answer all your questions. Give us a call if you have any, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if it's really important to you, let the screener know, are you for or against passenger rail in Ohio? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The WOSU Winter Membership Drive begins tomorrow, and we have to get to $20,000 before the end of today to get a pledge-free day during the drive. So make your pledge right now at wosu.org/pledgefree.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides anytime with the online archive. Podcast new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/All Sides. 35 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and steady temperatures in the mid-30s. A few clouds tonight and a low of 20 degrees. Some sunshine for Thursday and a high of 38. And a rain-snow mix is possible on Friday, a high of 35. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Hello, neighbor. Welcome aboard.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You know, if you're wondering, why do I have such old-fashioned songs about railroads on the radio? It's because passenger rail hasn't been around in the sense that it used to be. It's not as big a part of our life anymore, and there are no modern songs about railroads. They all harken back to the good old days.
1971, since the last train rolled between Columbus, Cleveland, and Cincinnati.
Yeah, yeah. 39 years.
Yeah.
A whole generation.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of working on the railroad, let's talk about job development. Mm-hmm. And what sort of jobs immediately that the railroad will employ and ancillarily. In other words, what's the possibilities for an industry that would revolve around railroads?
Well, and a couple of things. And I want people to keep in mind that not only will this impact be felt in Ohio, but this is going to be an impact that's going to be felt nationwide. In Ohio, we're estimating about 255 immediate construction jobs. Many of those mean that the railroads will be calling back employees that have been laid off, in the recent past. We're estimating direct employment on the trains of being around 33 workers, with another possibly 110, 111 workers that would be involved in support,
maintenance,
car cleaning, repairs, things like that. We're looking at with the investment that Ohio got. The U.S. Department of Commerce has a formula that about $1 billion of investment in rail generates approximately 20,000 jobs nationwide.
Where do they get those kind of figures from? How do you do that?
I wish I understood formulas like that, but they've been able to basically come up with those formulas, looking at the experience, what kind of jobs generate out from any kind of transportation project. And this is true. This is as true of highways and aviation as it is for rail. I mean, you take a look at what has been generated just around the interstate highway system. You don't have an Interstate 71, you don't have a Polaris. In very simple, blunt terms. You know, the fact that we have a Polaris and a Tuttle Mall and other places around here is a direct impact of the investment that we made in our highways. This is also a major investment in our rail infrastructure. We've had and you talked about the freight railroads earlier. We've had the freight railroads at the planning table throughout the process, because we want to make sure that there's a benefit for the freight rail companies and the shippers in Ohio that use the railroads to get their products to and from.
You know, there's so many rail projects underway now. Are you worried about getting the supplies and the right labor pool to do to get started so quickly?
That is a concern, and it's a concern around the nation. I know I've read a recent article in one of the Portland, Maine newspapers about the getting ties and rails
right
to get their extension up to Brunswick, Maine started. And I don't want to steal Patricia's thunder, but that's something that she can probably talk about. But we also have an industry that pretty much disappeared in the United States, and that's the manufacturer of passenger rail cars. People remember, if they're around long enough, names like Budd and Pullman and American Car Foundries and others. There was even a company, and I can't remember their name, that was based in Dayton at the turn of the last century. And we don't have that industry anymore because we kind of got, you know, we disinvested in passenger rail over several decades. And there wasn't enough to keep these companies going. Colorado Railcar was a company that was the last of the breed, so to speak. They went into bankruptcy, but we have a local company now, U.S. Railcar, that purchased the assets of Colorado Railcar out of the bankruptcy court, and they want to open up a facility here in the Columbus area to start building passenger rail vehicles. There's certainly been a lot of interest expressed by foreign companies coming into the United States to build them. Talgo recently signed an agreement with the state of Wisconsin to open up a factory in Wisconsin and supply Wisconsin and other states with passenger rail equipment. I think the foreign companies are very definitely smelling the money in the United States. And, you know, and we not only have the labor force, but we've got the supply chain in the United States. And we've got, I think, something in the order of about 200 companies in the state of Ohio that in one form or another supply some arm of the railroad industry. So this could very definitely, you know, spread out into a lot of jobs, you know, not just in the 3C corridor, but around the states.
If you want to ask Stu a question, you can call us at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to Stu Nicholson. He's the Public Information Officer for the Ohio Rail Development Commission. We're talking about, surprise, surprise, passenger rail in Ohio. We have an email from Mike. He writes, I'm all for expanded rail in Ohio, particularly connecting the three C's and an eventual link to other cities and states. However, I think that it is a big mistake to limit the trains to the reported 79 mile per hour maximum. I really think a higher speed rail makes more sense. Mike has another question, but why don't we address that speed thing? Because that's a criticism of a lot of people.
Well, and certainly, yeah. Do we want to go faster? Absolutely. You know,
why so slow?
Well, you know, precisely because we haven't had passenger rail in this state and in many parts of this country for so long that there isn't that culture around passenger rail anymore, and consequently the states that have undertaken what we are undertaking right now started out incrementally. Many of those states got grants last Thursday to step that up to 110 miles an hour. So we look upon, you know, what we're doing in the 3C as essentially a starting point. We also have $7 million from ODOT's Transportation Review Advisory Committee, as well as a couple of congressional earmarks. And we are going to begin very soon, probably within the next month or so, the environmental assessment of four high-speed rail corridors within Ohio. One of them includes the 3C, but we also have Cleveland to Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Toledo, Detroit, and Columbus, Toledo, Detroit. So, you know, we are projecting out ahead. We are planning out ahead to add those corridors, to add those services, to make that ramp up to 110 miles an hour. But it's very difficult both in terms of funding and political will to go from 0 miles an hour to 110 miles an hour. Ohio has had four attempts in the past to institute high-speed rail, including high-speed rail in the European sense of the word, 200-plus miles an hour. They've all failed in the past. You know, we want to try and do this deliberately, incrementally, and build this up so that we can get up to that point and lay that foundation for faster, better trains.
I wanted to get to another email quick before Senator Husted gets on the line. It's from Rich. He asks, what, if any, currently operating rail services might Ohio's proposed – I don't know if it's a proposed rail anymore, but might Ohio's rail be modeled on?
Well, we've got a lot of models to look at. There are 14 other states that have done what we're starting to do right now that are already operating state-supported corridors, Maine being a good example, Wisconsin, Illinois, North Carolina, Virginia, Michigan, that state up north, has state-supported mm-hmm. rail. California's capital corridors, the state of California in general. California got a grant to go to high-speed rail in that European sense of the word, 200 mile an hour plus. But I am absolutely convinced that California voters would never have approved the bond issue that they passed in November of 2008 had they not previously passed two statewide bond issues to build conventional speed rail and build what is really probably the model for successfully operating that. Their rail pass ridership on many of their corridors is in the 50% range.
It's interesting in California, which is practically destitute at the state level. The rail authority, or how whatever it's called, is flourishing.
Yeah,
they're doing very well.
They've got the top 10 passenger rail corridors in the United States. They've got six of them in California. The poster child for the automobile is California, California. But yet they've got one of the most sophisticated passenger rail systems of any state in the United States.
Senator Houston, are you there?
I am.
Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Senator John Houston, your district is kind of wraps around the city of Dayton.
Yes, it would. The rail would go through my district. Yes.
So, why do you oppose it?
Well, opposing it is probably too strong a word. Why do I have many concerns about it that I think need to be justified before we move forward? Really. I'll talk about it in this context. We're a nation that has a $12.4 trillion national debt. We have, if you cost that out, that's more than $40,000 per person. We are a state that has a upcoming shortfall in our budget of $8 billion that we're going to face going forward. And what we have right now as a legislator is a project that was put before us that at first in March, it was said that it would cost $250 million. A week later, we were told that that was a rough estimate. By June, the governor was warning that the cost on this could increase. By September, Amtrak said it would cost $343 million. A little bit later, we applied for $564 million, which was we were told the cost is. We only received $400 million. And you can't answer. And when you look at the additional questions, the subsidy was first targeted at $10 million a year. Now that's gone up to $17 million a year. And what my concerns are is that what we're being told on this particular issue keeps changing, and that we are not getting all the facts before we move forward with this project.
Public projects never change in price, huh, Senator Houston?
I didn't say that they never did. I'm just saying that as a legislator whose job it is to oversee the budget for the taxpayers of the state, I think we have a responsibility to get the advocates on this issue to commit to us what the true costs of this are going to be, and that if it's going to cost $400 million, then that's all it should cost. Because of what I worry about is this is going to be just like the banks. It's going to become too big to fail, and then once we commit $400 million, they'll say, well, we just need another $100 million. We don't want that $400 million to go to waste, and then it's another $100 million. And then the subsidy is going to be, $17, then $30 million a year, which, by the way, no one has identified where the subsidy revenue will come from for this. I think that that is something that the advocates have a responsibility to do up front. And when you look at the schedule, I think that the estimates for how many people are actually going to ride this, and obviously as a result of that, the viability of the long-term plan financially are exaggerated. Because when you look at the real schedule here, what something I might use the train for is to go from Dayton to Cincinnati for a Reds game, okay? And I can leave Dayton on time. Here's the practical matter. I live in Kettering. I can drive downtown to get on the train. I park my car. I get on the train. I go to Cincinnati. I can get there in time for the game. But there's no train that comes back from the game that same day. And so I'd have to get a hotel room, stay overnight, and then miss half a morning. You wouldn't get back until, 9 or 10 o'clock the next morning after having to also pay, $10 to leave my car there overnight. The practicality of what this plan really is, I think, overestimates how many people will actually use it, which is going to create a bigger financial burden in the long run. Those are my concerns. I think they're legitimate concerns that deserve to be addressed.
Senator Houston, is there a model out there that you're looking at that has failed and that's telling you this is a bad investment or this is a bad risk?
No, it's the words of the people who have been promoting the project in Ohio and the Amtrak study that was just commissioned and reported back to Ohio on December the 18th that draw all of these issues into question.
Stu Nicholson of the Ohio Rail Development Commission. That's always a good question. It seems like the price keeps going up. It happens with a lot of public works projects, but this one is different in a way.
Well, different and yet not. I mean, you know, again, major public works projects, by their very nature, you see costs adjust, you see estimates adjust. We certainly share the senator's concern, and we want very much to be able to work with him and his colleagues in both the Senate and the House on making sure this is done in a very cost-effective manner, because we share that concern over covering the operating costs. The estimate is that we'd get about $12 million out of the fare box, but that still leaves $17 million. And as you and I had discussed a little bit earlier, we are really leaving nothing off the table as a potential revenue generator, so that we don't have to dip into GRF funding, things like that, to support this year after year after year. You know, we draw our experience not just from the Amtrak study, but from the experience of other states that have gone through this. And I think Patricia Quinn, when she comes on later in the show, will talk about this as well. We're not reinventing the wheel here. We've looked at what other states, especially Midwestern states, our neighbors in Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, what they've done, how they've gone about creating service, expanding that service, covering those operating costs, managing the expenses. It's putting something like this together is very much an iterative process. You know, you ballpark your figures to begin with. You start your study. You start to get into the details. We still have details that we have to get into. We've got, for instance, we have to negotiate access agreements with the railroads and to sit down and work with them as we have since the beginning, as to what infrastructure fixes need to be done on the corridor, not just to enable passenger rail, but to make sure that what they do as a business, the movement of freight, not only continues to flow as it does, but actually improves.
Stu, does the $400 million or the ultimate cost, does that include the cost to build the stations in Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati,
that,
and Dayton?
All of that is folded within that $400. Those are all of the capital costs.
Senator Houston, we had an emailer that sent us in some ideas for raising funding, cell sponsorships, sell deep discount prepaid rail passes, and also issue rail bonds, which Ohioans could purchase using their pension and IRA plans. Do you have any ideas about raising revenue?
Well, I don't, because I think this should be self-sustainable. I'm not a big fan of putting a further tax burden on people to subsidize this, and this is why. We're subsidizing so many things right now that that we're in a situation that we can't afford the government that we already have. We can't afford to pay for the services that we've already had. And so you're putting yourself in a situation where I think the future for America and the future for our state in terms of the things that government is going to be able to do is that list is shrinking, not growing, in terms of our financial ability to afford let me just point to an Associated Press article that came out yesterday that talked about the fact that there's $8 billion that was awarded in stimulus funds to create 13 high-speed rail corridors, even though ours isn't a high-speed corridor. But it says that the money isn't even enough to finish. You know, it's about half the money that it's going to take. And when you look at President Obama's budget that he just introduced, one of the things that's going to be froze or cut going forward is actually the subsidy for rail. And so the federal government's not going to have this money in the future, and Ohio is not in a position to have it. And so I'm just so we have to ask these questions, and we have to get answers.
Right.
To them.
Well, I was asking
so we know what the plan is.
Well, I want to hear your ideas.
Financially viable.
The ideas that the emailer had was sell sponsorships and advertising. That's not putting the burden on the taxpayers.
Well,
but Senator, I want to get back to that.
Hang on.
No, we have to take a break right now. I'll come back to it. I promise.
All
this
right.
is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Colin Firth was just nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in A Single Man, playing a college professor whose longtime lover has died.
Everything's actually falling apart completely inside. But I think if he gives in to hysterical misery, then it'll become real, and he's not ready for that.
We'll talk with Colin Firth on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning and thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. The WOSU Winter Membership Drive begins tomorrow, and we have to get to $20,000 before the end of today to get a pledge-free day during the drive. Make your pledge right now at WOSU.org/pledge-free. That's WOSU.org/pledge-free. And thank you for your support of WOSU 820 NPR News. 35 degrees in downtown Columbus under cloudy skies, clouds for most of the day, and a high right around the mid-30s. A few clouds tonight and a low of 20 degrees. Some sunshine on Thursday and a high of 38. Looking ahead to Friday, expect a rain-snow mix on Friday and a high right around 35. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was the ever-great Chet Atkins and the Orange Blossom Special. Senator Houston, I want to get back to that issue about funding, but first I want to introduce our next guest, Patricia Quinn. She is the Executive Director of the Northern New England Rail Passenger Rail Authority. Hi, Patricia.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for joining us. We were just talking about private funding sources, and I mentioned some from an emailer that I received selling sponsorships and advertising on the trains and in the stations, issuing rail bonds providing deep discount prepaid rail passes. And, Senator, I was wondering, those aren't necessarily putting an additional burden on taxpayers.
I'd be happy to address them. First of all, advertising revenue is already factored into the feasibility study that Amtrak has offered, so that was always going to be part of the financing system. Rail bonds ultimately need to be paid back like any bond, plus interest, so if it's not making money in the long run, you still have to have a public subsidy to pay those rail bonds back. What was the third issue?
Deep discount prepaid rail passes. That kind of thing.
That could put more riders on the trains, but it's not going to help with your financial viability if you're not drawing the revenue that you need to actually fund the operation. So I don't have any problems with all three of those, but they've either been already accounted for or don't solve the long-term financial viability issue as it relates to the subsidy that will occur to operate it.
Patricia Quinn of the Northern New England Passenger Rail Authority, you have been in the business in New England there since 2001, and you were around when this opened, when the line that you operate now opened. You weren't in charge of it at the time, but you were around. You know, there was a lot of conflict over it, a lot of controversy over it. How has it survived as well as it has?
We did start operating in 2001, and it was about a 12-year initiative to get the service up and going. And really, the service has done amazingly well. Our ridership projections have, exceeded, I think, what they expected the service to do from a performance level. And the other piece of it is that it really has been an economic generator for our area and has sparked a tremendous amount of private development that has helped kind of round out some of the questions that you have around subsidies and public benefits.
What kind of development are you talking about, private development?
Well, in Saco, which is our second station after Portland, very small community, old mill community. There's been abandoned mills. They've been empty for decades, and nobody even had any interest in them whatsoever. Adjacent to the train station, and a developer has come in and is permitted and is in the process of spending about $100 million to renovate those old mills and make it a classic transit-oriented development environment of condos, apartments. There's a brewery in there now and some restaurants. There's going to be some meeting space. they found this to be a great location because it's on the river, and they can appeal to people from Boston who want to come up and hold meetings and be able to live here and get to work in Boston. So that's one. We also have in Durham, which is where our university is, a stop right in the university campus. That university has invested quite a bit of money in updating their stations, their station that they have there. Changed it from an old kind of dairy bar format to a restaurant that serves all sustainable products and foods. And then in Brunswick, where we have just also received a grant to expand our service 30 miles to Brunswick, a private developer has already begun a transit-oriented development project there, keeping his fingers crossed that the train would actually come. But they built the train station is there. They rented out the rest of it for office space and a restaurant and will now pursue phase two, which is the development of a hotel. And in Old Orchard Beach, which is a resort community, there's been about 808 new residential housing units that have been built in that area since the train started, including a $22 million condominium complex adjacent to the train platform.
Patricia, you know, a lot of people share Senator Husted's concerns about long-term viability. Your operation has been successful. I'm still looking for a failure out there in recent history. Obviously, railroads failed for a long time. They're coming back. But I wondered, what kind of advice would you give a state like Ohio that is just getting into this game in terms of an interstate operation?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, in terms of the operation itself, I mean, it's important that you run a good service that provides a good transportation benefit, because that, after all, is really the first reason that you're there. If people want to ride your service and you get good ridership, then a lot of the rest of it will fall into place, and that will make people want to invest near that, near the different stations. But I think, you know, another thing is that you really have to market it. You can't just expect that it's going to be there and people are going to ride it. We work at it every day, generating riders, and a lot of the things you just talked about are things that we did. And from a political standpoint or the perspective of a state, you can't expect that it's going to make money. It's public transportation. Public transportation doesn't make money. That's why it's called public transportation. And I think there's, you know, I did an interview the other day with a colleague of mine from the Maine DOT who, you know, pointed out that, you know, we invest in our highway systems, we invest in ports and airports, but we subsidize rail. And really, we have to put the passenger rail transportation industry at parity with the other forms of transportation. We either invest in all of them or we subsidize all of them. But we need to just kind of get over that hump to think that this is going to make money on its own balance sheet. Because all of the other things that we talked about in terms of job creation, construction benefits, making communities more livable, taking miles off of the road, those are all benefits that bring dollars into a state or a region but don't show up on my balance sheet.
Senator Husted, you were saying that that's all good and well, but you don't think it's necessarily government's role to be doing that sort of stuff anymore.
No, I didn't say it wasn't government's role. I just asked whether government can actually afford it. I understand that public transportation has to come from government on behalf of the people for something that they want and will use. I just would say that a couple of things related to that is that, you know, people want to live and be able to go to work, and look, that is a perfectly viable way to use rail, buses, or whatever it is. But that's not what our plan is in Ohio. You can't live in Cleveland and get to Columbus for work. You can't live into Dayton and get to Cincinnati for work, because that's not how the train schedule works. You can't get a train after 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in some of these situations.
Stu Nicholson, can you respond to that?
Well, what does
that mean? That is a good point, and some people are complaining that they can't come
home
from the
system that we have planned now. I mean, some of the scenarios that the senator just talked about going down to Cincinnati for a ball game.
That's a big complaint.
And a legitimate one, but it is a startup system. We don't want to just get the trains in a 3C corridor, slap ourselves in the back and say what a great job we did and walk away from it. I think, as Patricia talked about, it's a constant marketing effort. You want to expand service. They've certainly done that in Maine. They've gone from, correct me if I'm wrong, but 3 trains a day up to 5 trains a day. They're going to be adding more trains in the corridor. And as you do that, as you incrementally improve your service and add frequencies and add to that schedule, then you get to that point. Initially, you know, it'd be difficult to go to Cleveland and go to a ball game in Cleveland and not have to have an overnight stay. But at some point, that our goal is to be able to enable that for the state of Ohio.
And the thing of it is that, you know what, the people of Ohio may ultimately decide that's what they want. But let's be realistic about the costs associated with this. If we're losing about $5 million a train in subsidy per year, if you add another one, that means we're losing $5 million more, essentially. And what we just need, is if there is a plan, as Mr. Nicholson outlined, for the future, then lay that plan out. What are the costs of that plan? How do we plan to pay for it, so that we don't get ourselves in a situation where, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the show, where we get a hold of something that becomes too big to fail and the subsidy becomes – look, if you're an advocate for rail, you should want to have all these questions mm-hmm. answered so that it doesn't come back on you, so that, you know, so that the people who are critics, you know, you give them the ability to criticize what you've done if you haven't done it the right way.
Stu, is there a plan laid out yet?
That's exactly what we're working on. I think if you recall earlier, I said we still now that the money is here, the $400 million is here. Now we have to work with the Federal Railroad Administration as to what their expectations are in terms of service. We have to work with our partners at ODOT. Certainly, we have to bring those discussions and what comes out of them to the senator and his colleagues, because he's absolutely right. We need to, but getting these details, as I said, is an iterative process. Mm-hmm. So this is exactly what we're working on: are those costs, are those budgets. What can we do? What other alternatives and options do we have, especially in regards to the operating costs? So,
if people want to learn more about what so far, where do they go to learn more about it?
I would give you our address, web address, but
We'll put a link on our website, wosu.org/allsides.
And even if you Google the Ohio Rail Development Commission, you can get that. But I would also encourage people to take a look at some of what is going on in the other states. I know the Downeaster service has a very good website, and you can really get an idea as to what their marketing is, and even ridership reports, things like that. They've been very, very, very it's been a very transparent operation for them. People can look at what the ridership has been. People can look at how they market it. Maine is one of the models that we looked at here in Ohio as to how to do it and do it right.
Patricia, anything else to add about how to do it right that you've learned, that maybe you started out on the wrong path and turned around and redid something?
Well, we actually did. After a 12-year process to get the train going, I think the folks that were here before me were just happy to get the train going, and it took every bit of energy that they could to make that happen. And what we found out is that our schedule wasn't great. We go into North Station in Boston. We share track space there with the MBTA, who brings in 30,000 people a day on a commuter rail. So our schedule wasn't great, and it took us some time to really focus on the fact that we were providing transportation to people and try to make that as good as we can. But as Stu alluded to, it really was an incremental process. We started off with 4 trains a day at times that really weren't convenient for anybody. And a travel time that was 2 hours and 45 minutes, which was way too long for anybody. So we had that little bump when we started, a little bit of initial success because it was a novelty. Once the novelty wore off, we realized we really needed to focus on what the job was that we were here to do. So we've made those improvements. We've made additional investments, and it's really paid off in terms of, you know, the ridership that we have. Our corridor is 116 miles long, and there are a dozen people, I can tell you right now, that have commuter passes that take our train every day to go to work in Boston, because it doesn't make for a real viable commute. But we also have 200 other people that are on our second train that go because they're going for medical appointments, to visit people, school kids going on field trips, going to events, connecting to other services, a variety of different reasons. With equipment, there are logistics involved with equipment moves back and forth, and it's marketing and targeting the best you can to try to, you know, maximize, you know, your seat utilization, and then look for where there's room for improvement. And this is a process for us. We're still growing. You know, we had an application that wasn't funded, but we're out to, you know, reduce our travel time more, Portland to Boston, and to add some more trains. And to your senator's point, I mean, you know, we look at this as a business, and you're right. You need to answer these hard questions, and our job here is to run this as and provide as much public benefit as efficiently as possible, and convince our legislators every single day that it's worth the public investment. And that's what I would just remind the folks there to do, is that you can't take it for granted. It's money, it's public money, and you have to make sure that you're providing a project. But I would think that with your project and your population base, you know, you've got a lot going for you, and I really believe you're going to be very successful.
We've got lots of emails. We've got lots of phone calls. One email was questioning, it was complaining that we don't treat railroads the same way we treat highways, and when are we going to start looking? And I think Stu brought that up, or maybe it was Patricia, that somebody did, that it was, we always call it subsidies instead of investments when we talk about railroads. We don't hold highways to the same sort of standard. But I wanted to bring on a caller who has a question. He says the big difference, that there is a big difference between rail and highway. Joe, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
This is Joe.
You're finally on the air.
Yeah, okay.
We're running out of time, though, as usual. So.
Well, I'll try to tell you this. We don't want to tax ourselves to the extent to pay for any of these things. When your man Eisenhower built the highway system, we had a 91% maximum tax rate, income tax rate. We went along for 1 year after that at 77. Then we went for, I think it was 17 years, where we had a 70% maximum tax rate. Then we went for 5 years at 50. And now we've been wallowing for more than 20 years down in the 30s. And we don't want the taxes. The people don't want care about the numbers. All they want is tax cuts.
Okay.
And we can't all do right. these things if we don't pay for it.
All right, Senator Husted. Thanks, Joe.
Can I talk just a little bit about this issue of subsidy versus investment?
Yeah, for 30, like we're running out of time.
First
so
of all,
yes, Senator.
The highways, we tax ourselves. It's almost a user fee for highways. Gas tax paid for by people who use the roads are what pay for the highways. That's how that works. Okay, so what we need to do is identify, okay, if this is what we want to do with rail and the public wants to do this, which they have rejected it at the ballot on 3 occasions, which is worth noting, then what is that? Where is the money going to be from? Where is the dedicated resource that we're going to have? Because I think you need to answer that question and get public support by it if you're going to ultimately have a viable system that is promoted beyond just what it's being proposed, that it's being that is the source for resources that will be used to promote the growth in the future if that's what Ohio ultimately decides.
So, Senator Husted, you know, I mean, you've been in the legislature long enough to know that where there's a will, there's a way. So I'm wondering, do you think that there should ever be, I keep wanting to say commercial, but passenger rail in Ohio? Do you think this is something that is just something we shouldn't do right now? And if not now, when?
I don't know what the answer to that question is. I just know that what's been put forth right now in this particular plan has a lot of holes in it. And it's my responsibility to ask these questions. You know what? Mm-hmm. The people that are advocates for this, if they heed what I'm trying to explain to them, they will do themselves great benefit in the long run. Because if they get off to a wrong start on this, and if the early returns show that this is not working and that they didn't heed these warnings, they are going to undermine its long-term viability in Ohio.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is State Senator John Husted. He's also a candidate for Ohio Secretary of State. Appreciate your time today. Also, Stu Nicholson, Public Information Officer of the Ohio Rail Development Commission, and Patricia Quinn, all the way from Maine, Executive Director of the Northern New England Rail Passenger Authority. Thanks, Patricia, Stu, Senator Husted. Appreciate it. Sorry we ran out of time again. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.